Primetime for this Thursday. Elliot Friedman for the Vacationing Bob McCowan. Tim McAuliffe is the co-host tonight. He and Sid Sixero will host from here an Olympic opening ceremonies special for 6 hours tomorrow from 1 to 7 Eastern time.
That is correct. 6 hours. I wonder why Bob's not doing this.
He timed it perfectly.
Something tells me he knows better, Elliot.
He knew to come back on Monday, just as I knew not to volunteer for tomorrow. A couple of things coming up in this show. Dan Duquette, the Baltimore Orioles general manager. Don Banks from SI.com. As the NFL training camps open up today, he was in Washington. But as David Poyle joked yesterday, there is no summer anymore in the National Hockey League. We've gone from Zach Parise and Ryan Suter to Shea Weber, and now we go to Alex Semin, who today signs a one-year, $7 million contract with the Carolina Hurricanes. And joining us now from Toronto, where he's been attending negotiation sessions, is the general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes, Jim Rutherford. Jim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What is more exciting, negotiating a new CBA or signing Alex Semin to a contract?
Well, I guess they kind of go hand in hand when you get to the end of the day, but certainly from the Hurricanes' point of view, bringing Alex Semin on board excites us. And we've done a lot of homework on this player. I know there's different things being said out there publicly, some negative, some positive, but the fact of the matter is he's a very, very talented player, and we were looking for a top six forward, and we're very happy to have him.
Here's your quote today from the Carolina Hurricanes news release, and you kind of alluded to it a bit there. We have done a lot of research about Alexander, and discussions about his fit with our team have included people at many different levels of our organization, including players, coaches, and staff. Now, Jim, you are correct. There is probably no player who's had more negative things said about him since the end of the season than Alex Semin. What kind of research did you do, and what did it tell you?
We just talked to as many people as we could that have in some way been associated with him. And clearly the negatives outweighed or the positives outweighed the negatives. Another thing, I mean, we have different ways of compiling stats and how players do and in different situations and in key situations. And, you know, one of the things that's talked about Alex is, you know, what he does in key situations. And the fact of the matter is, based on our records, he's a key player at key times of the game, and quite a bit opposite to what people that don't do their homework on him say. So we're very comfortable. The other thing about this is I hope this is a long-term relationship with Alex and the Hurricanes. But if it's not, we've made a one-year commitment to him, and he'll get to know us, we'll get to know him, and hopefully it's a good fit, and hopefully it's long-term.
You haven't heard a ton about analytics in hockey. What made you look at those kind of analytics and then apply them to Semin?
Well, over the last few years, this has really become a big part of our research with the Hurricanes. And we have, right now, we have several different packages that we use. And, you know, we obviously use the key people in our organization for their opinion. But to have the analytics that we use, it's very helpful. And in this case, it was more than helpful.
Well, the Carolina Hurricanes have a terrific PR staff. One of their individuals, his name is Mike Sundheim. His last name is spelled Sundheim. That is his Twitter handle, at Mike Sundheim. And he spent a bit of time today tweeting about some of the things that you guys looked at for Semin, Jim. I don't know if he's now fired for giving away proprietary information or that was okay. But one of the things he talked about was high-pressure situations.
Yep.
And, you know, what kinds, like, what is that to the Hurricanes? What do you guys define as that?
Well, high-pressure situations when you're playing against the other team's top players, at what point in the game does he perform? Obviously, key points of the games is depends on the score, depends on what time of the game, late in the game, late in periods, and key times, like I said, when the score is tied or when you need to tie the game. All those different things come into play. And it's a very useful tool. I mean, it's the same as it's not foolproof. Just the same as the people that work in organizations' opinions aren't foolproof. But when you put them both together and the information that we compiled, it looks pretty good for this guy.
Obviously, a $7 million investment is a significant one. It comes after the acquisition of Jordan Staal. Was there something that told you that this was the year that you wanted to shake up this team a little bit?
Well, when we started to rebuild, when we won the Cup, we had an older team, and we started to rebuild, and then we had a good year in between there where we went to the conference finals and started adding a player like Jeff Skinner and Justin Falk, and Talusti's come along really nice for us. And we have, everybody knows our top players, the Stalls and the Wards and guys like this. Gleason's a team leader. But we felt that we're getting to the point now that the pieces are starting to come together where we feel that we can start to contend again. And the way Falk played in the second half of last year as a 19-year-old defenseman was a big step for our team to start to feel that way. So when we looked at our team and then we were able to add Jordan Staal and we really looked at it, getting another top six forward was very important for us. And if Alex Semin can come in and score 30 to 40 goals for us and our other players play the way they're capable, I think the Hurricanes are in a very strong position this year.
Jim Rutherford is our guest, the president and general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes, who signed Alex Semin today. Jim, I'm just curious about your opinions on what has been going on around you. You saw Shea Weber get a $110 million offer sheet with huge bonuses the first 4 years and have it matched. You saw twin $98 million contracts in Minnesota. You know, you've been at the bargaining table too. What has been the reaction to this around the league?
Well, I don't know totally what it is around the league, but from my point of view, it's all within the rules of the CBA that we're working under. But with that being said, and I'm sure some people are going to say something after I just give a guy $7 million for 1 year, but there's only maybe seven or eight teams that can do some of the things that have been done this year. And so that's part of why we're looking at adjusting the CBA that we're in. But certainly nothing. No one's done anything out of the CBA, and nobody's done anything wrong. And teams have done what they felt were right for their individual teams to make them better, and that's the way it works.
With the front-loaded deal that Philadelphia gave to Shea Weber, some people felt the optics of a quote-unquote poison pill contract was a big market team going after a small market team. How would you respond to those people?
I don't think you can look at it that way. I think you look at it as to what a team thinks works for them. And Philadelphia was within their rights to do what they did. Mm-hmm. They felt that was a contract that they were comfortable with. They went after one of the top defensemen in the league, and then everything unfolded from there. As we all know, Nashville had the right to match. They did. They did what they had to do. It would have been a big blow for them to lose that player. And so I know it's big numbers, and it's the way the system works, but both teams did what they felt were best for their teams.
Jim, you're heading home now. This is where I know I'm getting into some interesting territory. Are there another round of negotiations set up?
I don't know if I'm supposed to be the person to say that, so I'll just answer yes. And then I'll let the people that are supposed to speak to that speak to us.
Okay, and this is as far as I'm going to try and move the line. Anything interesting happened today?
Yeah, I think you moved it as far as you can with me. Unfortunately, I'm not the guy to be talking about this. So
I understand. Just before we let you go, you've done a lot of interesting things to your hockey team this year. I know there's a lot of excitement in your market with what you've done. Any chance that Jeff Skinner gets an extension, or is there any chance you're going to do anything else with your team?
There's always a chance on both those questions. Jeff Skinner's a very big part of the Hurricanes, and we love this guy as a person and a player, and we want him there for a long time. As far as our team goes, if we could add an enforcer or a gritty forward for the right price in a trade, I think we'd try to do that. But we're not. There's no urgency for it. I mean, we can start the season with the team we have now and do very well. But as time goes along, we may look at one of those types of players.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the signing, and I hope the weather allows you to get home tonight.
I hope so, too. I've been caught in the Toronto airport on bad nights, and it's not a fun place to be.
No.
I think there are thousands of travelers listening to this show agreeing with you on that 100%. Thanks for your time, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Rutherford, the president and general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes. And, Tim, you started asking him about the stats. And you know now in sports, ever since Moneyball, there is a group of people who believe in that kind of metric counting more than anything else when it comes to analyzing games, whether it's hockey, baseball, and they're still in the infancy in terms of what they can do in hockey. But I thought the Hurricanes, through Rutherford there and Mike Sunheim, their PR guy's Twitter feed today, probably revealed more or as much as any hockey team has probably admitted that they do it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I hope it doesn't lead to a round of hockey nerds to go along with the baseball nerds that spout off.
Why are you so against nerds?
You know, it's so funny, too, because I'm a huge stats guy.
I thought you were going to say, you know, I'm a huge nerd.
Yeah, that too. I got the glasses to prove it now.
Yep.
But it seems like, to me, that even Moneyball, maybe it's made it worse, but people, like, stats are they tell a lot, but they don't tell everything. I always say that stats are like Saturday nights on Tele Latino. They show a lot, but they don't show everything.
That's
okay. And I understand it in the realm of the way Jim explained it, and it was a perfect way to explain it. They aren't foolproof, just like people's eyes aren't foolproof.
Right.
And anyone who espouses just one of those things along the way really bugs me. And it seems like in baseball, there's a lot of people who just point to stats. And stats don't tell everything.
Well, it's happening in hockey, too, now.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. The proper marriage is in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the one thing is, I was interviewed once by a guy who wanted to ask me about what kind of statistical knowledge I used, and it was a really good interview. I enjoyed doing it, but I got an email about it because I talked about how you can't quantify a guy's heart.
Yeah.
And I got an email from a guy who's like, heart is the most overrated thing. It doesn't exist. People who talk about heart also talk about how a player is in the dressing room, and it's stupid and it's useless and it doesn't matter, and it's just a stupid cliche that sports media uses. And that kind of thinking, it drives me insane, because it's like, you know, if you are solely judging people based on numbers, it's why bean counters can't run a lot of organizations.
Right.
Because you're afraid to fail.
Right.
You don't have the guts to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the great leaders in the world, or most of the great decision makers in the world, have the guts to be wrong. And that's what separates them from your average CEO or general manager or president.
Yeah, it strikes me as someone who has never been in that seat and or has never played sports. The one thing,
or that, always lost at them.
Right. The one thing that
sort of like I did,
I had to get used to in this industry, was that 50% of the people who love sports just as much as anyone else have never played sports and sometimes don't understand football speed or heart or basketball IQ or hockey IQ. There's no way to quantify why Wayne Gretzky was the greatest player on planet Earth. If you look at his stats, I mean, skating-wise, it doesn't explain his vision. It doesn't explain how he got to the puck before everybody else. He wasn't the greatest skater.
Or how he knew it was where it was going.
Didn't have the hardest slap shot. Didn't have all those things that you can measure. Gretzky had average numbers in all those. And then you look at his numbers at the end of the season and nothing about them were average.
It was interesting, though, to hear Carolina play all that stuff to Salmon because, yeah. And Jim mentioned how many people they spoke to. There are a lot of people who've hammered Alexander Salmon over the last little while. It'll be interesting to see how it works out there.
Could that be a rationalization of signing a guy for $7 million?
It's a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one.
You know, they clearly they did their research.
Right.
And they gave him 1 year.
They gave him 1 year.
And if it's not going to work out with Jordan and Eric Staal, it's never going to work.
Yeah, no, it's a perfect marriage. You get him for the year, and if you want to re-sign him, you can sign him to an extension in the middle of the year if you want.
Absolutely. Yeah. After January 1st, I believe.
Speaking of analytics.
Let's take the break. When we come back, the general manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and speaking of analytics, PitchFX, which you followed, if you're a baseball fan, you know about it, inserted in stadiums since 2006. And that's what the Orioles are using to judge some of their pitchers. Dan Duquette, the GM, is next as Primetime continues. General manager of the Baltimore Orioles will join us in just a couple of seconds. His phone has gone from off to ringing.
This is a positive thing.
Which is what we call progress in the digital age.
Right.
We've got Don Banks coming up next segment, SI.com. People may not know this too much about Tim, but you were a football coach.
Kind of.
I saw one of the games.
Yeah, you came out and supported me. Yeah.
He coached at Sandor O'Connor High School in Toronto.
And you got mad at me for allowing the kids to cut on the offensive line.
Oh, boy. I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up because I think Duquette is there. He is there? Okay, so we'll do him first, and then we'll do that after. Because
well,
that's
ask him
situation.
If he ever coached football, whether he would.
No, we got about 5 or 6 minutes, so we got to do this. The Baltimore Orioles are going through a resurgence this year. They were a consistent playoff team in the 90s, not so much lately. They have been a lot of struggles under owner Peter Angelos. This year, they're 52-47. They're a game and a half out of the wild card. And the man getting a lot of credit for that is Dan Duquette, the general manager of the Orioles. He joins us right now. Dan, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. How are you guys?
We're doing very well. And, you know, one of the things that people have been talking about is some of the pitching analytics that you are doing. You use PitchFX, which every ballpark has. But I guess there's also a program that you guys use from Bloomberg Sports. And how much can you tell us about the way you guys do things?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you I was a Pop Warner football coach.
There you go.
I hope there was no cut blocking.
Yeah, right. There's no cut blocking in Pop Warner. There's a mercy rule, too, right? If you go over 20 points and you beat your opponent, you got to take it easy on.
All right, so high school football, are you allowed to cut or no?
If the referee doesn't see you, you're allowed to cut.
All right.
But anyway, the analytics that we use, all the clubs have access to the PitchFX. They track virtually every movement on a Major League Baseball field these days. The technology's terrific. It helps the fans, and it also, makes the game interesting. But, it helps you measure your performance and make adjustments. And I think that, that's one of the biggest changes that I've seen. We use it to give feedback to players, to show them how in their delivery will help them command their pitches, and then also how different adjustments and grip can produce better results in terms of more consistent movement on the ball in the strike zone. And then that's really what That's really what we use it for. A lot of the teams use the technology for the positioning for the fielders in the field. I'm sure you've seen that. Joe Maddon in Tampa, they use that overshift.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They've used it effectively against left-handed hitters. We started using it effectively against right-handed hitters this year. Buck Showalter took a look at the data, and we started overshifting on Albert Pujols, for example. So, you know, those are a couple of ways that you can utilize the technology. And, you know, we know from watching a game there's one or two or three plays that can influence the outcome of a game, right, in terms of your strategy and tactics. And that's, you know, one or two or three plays every night, you know, the position in the fielder in an area where he can, you know, catch the ball, or knowing the hitter's tendencies and knowing to go to a breaking pitch with men on base to get the hitter out. So, you know, these are the ways that technology can help us, and some of the ways that we've employed the technology to help the Orioles this year.
Dan, you also talked about grip and effect of the delivery. As you know, one of the big stories, unfortunately, in Toronto this year has been the injuries suffered by their pitching staff. This data that you collect and the way you use it, do you think it can help curtail serious injuries in pitchers?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, the whole experience of the industry, and I'm talking about pitchers everywhere, you know, pitching's an unnatural motion, right? I mean, if man was a descendant of the apes, you know, our arms were made to throw underhand instead of overhand. So the repeated stress of throwing overhand, you know, without proper conditioning or without doing it efficiently, you know, we really weren't made to do that. So a lot of the work that one of our pitching coaches in particular, Rick Peterson, does, he did with the American Sports Medicine Institute. Mm. And Dr. James Andrews did a lot of work with them over the years in terms of the efficiency of the deliveries. And I know from my former college coach, Bill Thurston, who's a terrific student of pitching and a great clinician. He also worked with Andrews. You know, they've been working on identifying, you know, five or six key fundamentals that the best power pitchers do in the big leagues. And so what we did in terms of utilizing the technology was we had all our top pitchers throw with high-speed video. They put the sensors on different components of their body. And then we tape it and, you know, track it electronically. And the idea is to help the pitchers identify the most effective delivery that they can repeat, but also the most efficient delivery so that they can stay healthy. And, you know, that's an exercise that we did in spring training and we're doing with a lot of our new signees. And that's another way to utilize the technology that's available in the marketplace, you know, to help have an educated, you know, pitching staff and hopefully a healthy one. I mean, you know, the team that wins the World Series every year is the team that keeps their starters healthy.
Yeah. Speaking of evolution, as we did with the apes to man, you've been a baseball lifer. How much have you had to evolve to take in, you know, phrases like technology in the marketplace?
Well, the I'm a Canadian, eh? Yes. My boys were born in Canada. So, you know, it's just part of, you know, being educated in your job, really.
Yeah.
I learned the fundamentals of scouting from some great scouts, you know, they really got their training with the Orioles. You know, I learned a system under Harry Dalton when he was the GM out in Milwaukee. You know, and you know, frankly, I watched Pat Gillick real close when he was in Toronto, and he did a terrific job. And a lot of the work that I did in Montreal, I tried to pattern after what I learned from Pat with those great Blue Jay organizations that he put together in the late 80s and early 90s.
Now, it's great to see baseball matter in Baltimore again. I mean, for those of us who grew up in Toronto like I did in the 70s and 80s, they were the franchise that everybody wanted to model themselves after. The Oriole way was the way that you were supposed to play baseball. What's it like to have that team competitive and the fans liking where you're going once again?
Well, you know that's interesting because the Orioles won more games from 1966 to 1992 than any other organization over that 25-year period. So they had a terrific operation. They had a great pitching operation, really, which was the strength of those teams. And, you know, we're trying to do that again here so we can get the Orioles back being competitive and being a perennial contender. So, you know, we're making a little progress this year. You know, it certainly reinvigorated the fans. You know, they've been inspired to come out and see us. We're almost, you know, a quarter of a million fans up over a year ago in terms of people coming through the gate. So, you know, we're starting to get people's attention. You know, we got some excellent young players. Adam Jones is a terrific everyday ball player. Matt Wieters, our catcher, is fun to watch. And, you know, we got some good pitching. Jimmy Johnson's having a terrific year. Our closer, and then this guy, Pedro Strop. I don't know if you've seen him, but he's just got, like, an electric fastball. So we got some good young players, and I think the fans are coming around a little bit.
One of the best ballparks in the majors. Yeah. It's good to see the bums in the seats back in it. Dan, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate you taking a couple minutes.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on, guys. Take care.
Dan Duquette, the general manager of the Baltimore Orioles, who are a game and a half out of the wild card after beating Tampa Bay 6-2 this afternoon. After our Tim Thomas discussion the previous hour. I didn't want to get into evolution,
yeah,
too.
No, I was going to say, don't ask Tim Thomas if they should be throwing underhand.
But I laughed at the beginning there. He agrees with your stance on cut blocking.
Well, kind of, not really. I don't think he did.
Well, he said if they don't call it,
right,
do it.
Right. But calling it is, it's not an illegal block. It's just,
it's dirty
at that age, whether or not you impose the block.
They're 15, 16, 17 year old.
Right.
Kids.
But let's be, no, hold on a second. Let's be honest. The school that I coached at is a very small school that played in a powerhouse league. And a lot of the kids that were lining up at offensive tackle and offensive guard were like 215 pounds. So to compete at the level that the kids wanted to compete at and not be scared of some of the guys that line up on the other side of you, I think that you're allowed to employ a tactic that would help them if they're just going to get run over repeatedly. It's not dirty, I'm telling you.
Cut blocking's not dirty?
If you cut block an engaged player, that's dirty.
Okay.
That's a chop block.
Yeah, all right.
Different.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah. But I understand.
I don't like it.
No, in Pop Warner, you're not allowed to cut block because everyone's the same weight. But when you're 15 and 16 years old, I'm trying to, on national radio, I'm trying to
justify
what it was. But at 15,
his injuring other 15 and 16 year olds.
No, not a kid got injured from what I remember getting chop blocked by one of my guys. But when there's such a big difference between the size of the kids and Pop Warner, you know, it's regulated by weight, right? You know that. And that's why they don't allow it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
It's regulated by weight. So when you have a 300-pounder going up against an offensive lineman who's 205 pounds, there's got to be something to even the field.
A foreign object?
Yeah. Is that how you played?
You went to
the foreign object?
We didn't have football at our high school.
Yeah.
So how long did you coach for?
I think I did 3 years before I started working too much at the previous incarnation. I would love to do it again. In fact, when I signed here, I was thinking, would I have a chance finishing at 4 to get down there and do it again?
Would you?
Would I? Yeah, but I don't think I have the time.
Why?
At 4, they practice right after school, so you get there at around, you know, if I was lucky, I'd get there at 5, and they'd be pretty much done.
Somewhere in Canada, well, more specifically, the Scarborough area, the east end of Toronto, there's a young kid saying, I'd love to have Tib McAuliffe as my high school football coach, and he is saying, sorry, kid.
I don't have time. They have a wonderful coach. Noel Karibs is the current coach at Senator O'Connor College in Don Mills.
Collegiate?
Yeah. No, college school.
They call it college school?
Senator O'Connor College School, my friend.
Talk about false
advertising. So Coach Karibs has got it covered, all right, Preach?
We got to take the break. After a conversation with Dan Duquette, it was a lot more interesting than the conversation between Tim and Elliot. When we come back, more football talk. The NFL camps opened yesterday. SI.com's Don Banks in Washington. Robert Griffin III. Can't wait to see him.
They'll be cutting in front of him, I'll tell you that much.
Yes, they will, as primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks. There is no bigger football fan I know than the man co-hosting this show, Tim McAuliffe.
Really?
Yep. You're a big football fan.
Yeah, I enjoy football.
A pig head, I guess we'd have to call it. Baseball fans are seam heads. Hockey fans are puck heads.
I am pig-headed.
You're a pig head.
Which makes the concussion issue all the more of a conundrum for Mr. McAuliffe.
Why's that?
Oh, I don't want to get into it because I'll, but I don't know if I'd let my son play football.
That is a debate for a different
segment. Another day, yeah.
Unless Don Banks wants to wade into it. Don?
What are we wagering?
No, the question is, would you let your son play football?
The history is that I've made my professional living on football, and I wonder whether or not I would let my son play football, who currently is two years old.
I would let my son play football. I think it's a far safer game today than it was, you know, a few years ago, and I think it's getting safer all the time. So, yes, I would probably go with the percentages. Most football players get out of it unscathed, relatively speaking, and I would, especially at the youth level, so I would let my son play football. I have two sons, so I'm qualified to answer that, guys.
Yeah, and it's definitely more, I honestly believe it's safer, I mean, even than it was 2 years ago, because people know and understand the risks that are involved.
Right.
Yeah.
How old are your boys, Don?
I have a 21-year-old son who's a senior to be at George Washington University in D.C., mm-hmm. and then I have a 14-year-old, and he's really a baseball fanatic, never really expressed a lot of interest in football, but loves to play backyard touch football in the fall and that sort of thing.
And what do they think about their dad's work on SI.com?
You know, they were slow to think it was a cool job, but then once they realized it had some currency at school and they could trade upon their dad's job a little bit and drop his name, suddenly dad's job became much, much more viable, much more cool topic of conversation. But I am still their parent, and that renders me somewhat uncool no matter what I do.
Well, I thought it was pretty cool today that as training camps open, you got a chance to go be in Washington with Robert Griffin III, RG3, with a burgundy shirt that read, "No pressure, no diamonds." I'm looking forward to seeing this guy.
He wore that yesterday at his presser, which I was at like at 5:30, kind of to kick off camp. You know, so far this guy, from a presentation standpoint, from every time he opens his mouth or represents the Redskins, he basically has not hit a false note yet. Now, he didn't have the best practice today in their first really full-scale workout. He was a little off timing wise. He looked a little shaky, as if he hadn't thrown to these receivers, you know, for a few weeks, and it showed. But I also think that he's going to get sharper and sharper as camp goes on, and he will. I think he'll continue the drumbeat in his own locker room of how many people absolutely think he's just a great, you know, great young quarterback waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. I've covered the league a long time, guys. There's been a lot of quarterback phenoms. I don't remember ever hearing as much enthusiasm from his own locker room as this guy is already engendering. To a man, they think they're going to ride this guy to big things.
It's funny because I went on record earlier this year saying that I thought that Robert Griffin III and Andrew Luck, barring injury, were going to be those, not only those franchise type quarterbacks, but those, you know, that we talk about being the greatest of all time. Now, obviously, injury has something to play in it, but you can say that these two guys could be the top prospects since Peyton Manning came into the league. Would you agree with that?
I do, and I didn't really think that way initially about Griffin, but I do think he's just a great next example of you know, the kind of current breed of quarterback who really can threaten the defense with his, as much with his legs as his arm. But you can't oversell his legs and undersell his arm, because his arm's really spectacular. It's accurate. He throws a great deep ball. I was talking to Joshua Morgan, the new Redskins receiver. He had a great line. He said he just throws like a toilet paper ball. It falls in your hands like in the movie Little Giants. And I said, I've never heard that. He said, it's the most catchable pass I've ever thrown.
Yeah.
He can hit you, you know, 60 yards downfield when he's running the opposite direction. He said, it looks like the ball is coming fast, but when it gets to you, it lands very softly in your hands. And I think... I think both those guys, I agree with you, I think they're both going to be elite quarterbacks at some point soon. And I think they'll be two of the best examples of you know, the collegiate quarterback turn into NFL superstar of some time.
Yeah.
Don, who's the best quarterback you've ever seen?
Well, I guess I would say Tom Brady in a clutch situation is the best quarterback, although for... You know, for a lot of years, I think I would have answered that Joe Montana. Now, I only saw the very end of John Unitas' career. I started watching football about 1969-70, so I didn't see Unitas in his prime. But I would probably go with Brady 1, Montana 2.
So when you see a quarterback like one of those two guys... And I don't want to compare these Luck and Griffin to that, because I think it's ridiculous, too soon and unfair. But I'm curious to know, what do you look for when you see greatness in a quarterback? What is the definition of that, of those characteristics to you?
To me, it's a guy that refuses to let his team lose the games that really matter, that he finds a way to win even when he doesn't have his best game. I think a guy that elevates the rest of his team. One thing I think Griffin is going to do, I think he's going to make everybody on that roster better by example of how he works and how much he wants it, how dedicated he is. I think people are really hungry to believe in him. I think he's the type of guy that's really easy to follow. And I think, when was the last time Washington had anyone at any position, let alone the most important position, that people really believed in, that people wanted to follow, and that really kind of delivered the goods? It just hasn't happened in the Daniel Snyder ownership era. I think this kid is that type of player that can actually even rescue a franchise.
We were discussing it off air, and especially in the quarterback position, and especially now, it seems to me like intelligence plays a huge factor in this, and not just because you know, football IQ, but like, just missteps off the field are compounded so much these days, and it seems like both Luck and Griffin are remarkably intelligent football players.
I agree with that. I think they both have been raised extremely well. Obviously, Griffin comes from a military background, and yet Luck's father played in the NFL and had a high-profile job after his career. I think both of these kids are going to pick up the pro game very quickly, as it seems to be the trend for young quarterbacks drafted very high. But secondly, I think they're going to, like you said, I think they're going to hit the right notes on the rest of the game, not just on field. The intelligence part, the how to present themselves. Obviously, Griffin kind of oozes charisma. Luck doesn't do badly either. It's just by comparison, he doesn't look as you know, as charismatic. But both of them know where they want to go and how to get there, and I think they both are going to get there.
Don, we got about a minute. I love these training camp tours that reporters get to do. What's your next highlight? What are you really looking forward to seeing?
Well, I'm actually driving as we speak. I left the Redskins about 15 minutes ago. I'm driving up to the Eagles camp tomorrow. I think they're a fascinating team. I'm picking them to win the NFC East. I think they're going to have kind of a bounce-back season. Last year, to me, was just, you know, absolute rock bottom. And I think they're still loaded with talent. It's just a matter, really, if Mike Vick plays 2010 style, they win big. If he's anywhere near 2011 style, it's probably curtains for him in Philly and possibly Andy Reid.
What a story. Yeah, that would
it's a
be.
Great story both ways.
Well, it gives you a good good blog to write tomorrow, that's for sure. Don, thank you
Absolutely.
Very much for
and
joining us.
Hit the Jets after that, and I'm sure there's nothing going
on
in the Jets camp. I'll probably be scrounging for ideas.
Don Banks of SI.com was funny today, Tim. I saw a tweet from one reporter said, awkward moment of the day. Somebody kept on asking Mark Sanchez questions, saying, well, Tim, and finally turned and said, a Mark.
Oh, my.
That's my ultimate nightmare.
That was probably someone Stern sent in. By the way, I like Don Banks. He agreed with me on everything.
I want to thank Arash Madani, Michael Grange, John Shannon, Sam Cosentino, Mike Zeisberger, Tim McAuliffe, Sid Sixero, Ryan Walsh, Matt Marchese, Jennifer Rolnick, and Neil Ustin for getting me through the last 2 weeks. Tim and Sid with their six-hour extravaganza of the Olympics tomorrow. Bob McCowan back next week. Thank you very much for listening over the past 10 days. Have a great night.